where Mr. Root left off. Burnham kept silent. He considered quitting the fair. Two forces warred within him. Grief and a desire to cry out that he, Burnham, had been the engine driving the design of the fair, that he was the partner who had propelled the firm of Burnham and Root to greater and greater achievement. The Eastern Architects departed on Saturday, January 17th. On Sunday, Burnham attended a memorial service for Root at Root's Astor Place house and his burial in Graceland Cemetery, a charming haven for the well-heeled dead a few miles north of the Loop. On Monday, he was back at his desk. He wrote 12 letters. Root's office next to his was silent, draped in bunting. Hothouse flowers perfumed the air. The challenge ahead looked more daunting than ever. On Tuesday, a large bank failed in Kansas City. The following Saturday, Lyman Gage announced he would quit as president of the fair effective April 1st to tend to his own bank. The fair's director general, George Davis, at first refused to believe it. "It's all nonsense," he snapped. "Gage has got to stay with us. We can't do without him." There was labor unrest. Just as Burnham had feared, union leaders began using the future fair as a vehicle for asserting such goals as the adoption of a minimum wage and an 8-hour day. There was the threat of fire and weather and disease. Already foreign editors were asking who would dare attend the exposition, given Chicago's notorious problems with sewage. No one had forgotten how in 1885 the city's fouled water had ignited an outbreak of cholera and typhoid that killed 10% of the city's population. Darker forces marshaled in the smoke. Somewhere in the heart of the city, a young Irish immigrant sank still more deeply into madness, the preamble to an act that would shock the nation and destroy what Burnham dreamed would be the single greatest moment of his life. Closer at hand, a far stranger creature raised his head in equally intense anticipation. "I was born with the devil in me," he wrote. "I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing." Part 2. An Awful Fight. Chicago, 1891-1893. Convocation. On Tuesday, February 24, 1891, Burnham, Olmsted, Hunt, and the other architects gathered in the library on the top floor of the Rookery to present drawings of the fair's main structures to the Grounds and Buildings Committee. The architects met by themselves throughout the morning, with Hunt serving as chairman. His gout forced him to keep one leg on the table. Olmsted looked worn and gray, except for his eyes, which gleamed beneath his bald skull like marbles of lapis. A new man had joined the group, Augustus St. Gaudens, one of America's best-known sculptors, whom Charles McKim had invited to help evaluate the designs. The members of the Grounds and Buildings Committee arrived at 2 o'clock and filled the library with the scent of cigars and frosted wool. The light in the room was sallow, the sun already well into its descent. Wind thumped the windows. In the hearth at the north wall, a large fire cracked and lisped and flushed the room with a dry scirocco that caused frozen skin to tingle. At Hunt's brusque prodding, the architects got to work. One by one, they walked to the front of the room, unrolled their drawings, and displayed them upon the wall. Something had happened among the architects, and it became evident immediately, as though a new force had entered the room. They spoke, Burnham said, almost in whispers. Each building was more lovely, more elaborate than the last, and all were immense. Fantastic things on a scale never before attempted. Hunt hobbled to the front and displayed his administration building, intended to be the most important at the fair and the portal through which most visitors would enter. Its center was an octagon topped by a dome that rose 275 feet from floor to peak, higher than the dome of the U.S. Capitol. The next structure presented was even bigger. If successfully erected, George B. Post's Manufacturing and Liberal Arts Building would be the largest building ever constructed and consume enough steel to build two Brooklyn bridges. All that space, moreover, was to be lit inside and out with electric lamps. 12 electric elevators would carry visitors to the building's upper reaches. 4 would rise through a central tower to an interior bridge, 220 feet above the floor, which in turn would lead to an exterior promenade offering foot-tingling views of the distant Michigan shore. A panorama, as one guidebook later put it, such as never before has been accorded to mortals. Post proposed to top his building with a dome 450 feet high, which would have made the building not only the biggest in the world, but also the tallest. As Post looked around the room, he saw in the eyes of his peers great admiration, but also something else. A murmur passed among them. Such was this new level of cohesion among the architects that Post understood at once. The dome was too much. Not too tall to be built, simply too proud for its context. It would diminish Hunt's building, and in so doing, diminish Hunt, and disrupt the harmony of the other structures on the Grand Court. Without prodding, Post said quietly, "I don't think I shall advocate that dome. Probably I shall modify the building." There was unspoken but unanimous approval. Sullivan already had modified his own building at Burnham's suggestion. Originally, Burnham wanted Adler and Sullivan to design the fair's music hall, but partly out of a continued sense of having been wronged by Burnham, the partners had turned the project down. Burnham later offered them the transportation building, which they accepted. 2 weeks before the meeting, Burnham wrote to Sullivan and urged him to modify his design, to create one grand entrance toward the east and make this much richer than either of the others you had proposed. "I'm sure that the effect of your building will be much finer than by the old method of two entrances on this side, neither of which could be so fine and effective as the one central feature." Sullivan took the suggestion, but never acknowledged its provenance, even though that one great entrance eventually became the talk of the fair. All the architects, including Sullivan, seemed to have been captured by the same spell, although Sullivan later would disavow the moment. As each architect unrolled his drawings, "the tension of feeling was almost painful," Burnham said. Saint Gaudens, tall and lean and wearing a goatee, sat in a corner very still, as if he were a figure sculpted from wax. On every face, Burnham saw a quiet intentness. It was clear to him that now, finally, the architects understood that Chicago had been serious about its elaborate plans for the fair. "Drawing after drawing was unrolled," Burnham said, "and as the day passed, it was apparent that a picture had been forming in the minds of those present, a vision far more grand and beautiful than hitherto presented by the richest imagination." As the light began to fade, the architects lit the library's gas jets, which hissed like mildly perturbed cats. From the street below, the top floor of the rookery seemed aflame with the shifting light of the jets and the fire in a great hearth. "The room was still as death," Burnham said, "save for the low voice of the speaker commenting on his design. It seemed as if a great magnet held everyone in its grasp." The last drawing went up. For a few moments afterward, the silence continued. Lyman Gage, still president of the exposition, was first to move. He was a banker, tall, straight-backed, conservative in demeanor and dress, but he rose suddenly and walked to a window, trembling with emotion. "You are dreaming, gentlemen. Dreaming," he whispered. "I only hope that half the vision may be realized." Now Saint Gaudens rose. He had been quiet all day. He rushed to Burnham and took his hands in his own. "I never expected to see such a moment," he said. "Look here, old fellow. Do you realize this has been the greatest meeting of artists since the 15th century?" Olmsted, too, sensed that something extraordinary had occurred, but the meeting also troubled him. First, it confirmed his growing concern that the architects were losing sight of the nature of the thing they were proposing to build. The shared vision expressed in their drawings struck him as being too sober and monumental. After all, this was a world's fair, and fairs should be fun. Aware of the architect's increasing emphasis on size, Olmsted shortly before the meeting had written to Burnham suggesting ways to enliven the grounds. He wanted the lagoons and canals strewn with waterfowl of all kinds and colors, and traversed continually by small boats. Not just any boats, however, becoming boats. The subject became an obsession for him. His broad view of what constituted landscape architecture included anything that grew, flew, floated, or otherwise entered the scenery he created. Roses produced dabs of red. Boats added intricacy and life. But it was crucial to choose the right kind of boat. He dreaded what would happen if the decision were left to one of the fair's many committees. He wanted Burnham to know his views from the start. "We should try to make the boating feature of the exposition a gay and lively one," he wrote. He loathed the clatter and smoke of steam launches. He wanted electric boats designed specifically for the park, with emphasis on graceful lines and silent operation. It was most important that these boats be constantly but quietly in motion, to provide diversion for the eye, peace for the ear. "What we shall want is a regular service of boats like that of an omnibus line in a city street," he wrote. He also envisioned a fleet of large birch-bark canoes paddled by Indians in deerskin and feathers, and recommended that various foreign watercraft be moored in the fair's harbor. "I mean such as Malay proas, catamarans, Arab dhows, Chinese sandpans, Japanese pilot boats, Turkish caiques, Eskimos kayaks, Alaskan war canoes, the hooded boats of the Swiss lakes, and so on." A far more important outcome of the rookery meeting, however, was Olmsted's recognition that the architect's noble dreams magnified and complicated the already daunting challenge that faced him in Jackson Park. When he and Calvert Vaugh designed Central Park in New York, they planned for visual effects that would not be achieved for decades. Here he would have just 26 months to reshape the desolation of the park into a prairie Venice and plant its shores, islands, terraces, and walks with whatever it took to produce a landscape rich enough to satisfy his vision. What the architect's drawings had shown him, however, was that in reality he would have far fewer than 26 months. The portion of his work that most would shape how visitors appraised his landscape, the planting and grooming of the grounds immediately surrounding each building, could only be done after the major structures were completed and the grounds cleared of construction equipment, temporary tracks and roads, and other aesthetic impedimenta. Yet the palaces unveiled in the rookery were so immense, so detailed, their construction was likely to consume nearly all the remaining time, leaving little for him. Soon after the meeting, Olmsted composed a strategy for the transformation of Jackson Park. His 10-page memorandum captured the essence of all he had come to believe about the art of landscape architecture, and how it should strive to conjure effects greater than the mere sum of petals and leaves. He concentrated on the fair's central lagoon, which his dredges soon would begin carving from the Jackson Park shore. The dredges would leave an island at the center of the lagoon to be called simply the Wooded Island. The fair's main buildings would rise along the lagoon's outer banks. Olmsted saw this lagoon district as the most challenging portion of the fair. Just as the Grand Court was to be the architectural heart of the fair, so the central lagoon and wooded island were to constitute its landscape centerpiece. Above all, he wanted the exposition landscape to produce an aura of mysterious, poetic effect. Flowers were not to be used as an ordinary gardener would use them. Rather, every flower, shrub, and tree was to be deployed with an eye to how each would act upon the imagination. This was to be accomplished, Olmsted wrote, through the mingling intricately together of many forms of foliage, the alternation and complicated crossing of salient leaves and stalks of varying green tints in highlights with other leaves and stalks, behind and under them, and therefore less defined and more shaded, yet partly illumined by light reflected from the water. He hoped to provide visitors with a banquet of glimpses. The undersides of leaves sparkling with reflected light, flashes of brilliant color between fronds of tall grass waving in the breeze. Nowhere, he wrote, should there be a display of flowers demanding attention as such. Rather, the flowers to be used for the purpose should have the effect of flecks and glimmers of bright color imperfectly breaking through the general greenery. Anything approaching a gorgeous, garish, or gaudy display of flowers is to be avoided. Sedges and ferns and graceful bulrush would be planted on the banks of the wooded island to conjure density and intricacy, and to slightly screen, without hiding, flowers otherwise likely to be too obtrusive. He envisioned large patches of cattails broken by bulrush, iris, and flag, and pocketed with blooming plants such as flame-red cardinal flower and yellow creeping buttercup, planted, if necessary, on slightly raised mounds, so as to be just visible among the swaying green spires in the foreground. On the far shore, below the formal terraces of the buildings, he planned to position fragrant plants such as honeysuckle and summersweet, so that their perfume would rise into the nostrils of visitors pausing on the terraces to view the island and the lagoon. The overall effect, he wrote, is thus to be in some degree of the character of a theatrical scene, to occupy the exposition stage for a single summer. It was one thing to visualize all this on paper, another to execute it. Olmsted was nearly 70. His mouth aflame, his head roaring, each night a desert of wakefulness. Even without the fair, he faced an intimidating portfolio of works in progress, chief among them the grounds of Biltmore, the Vanderbilt estate in North Carolina. If everything went perfectly, if his health did not degrade any further, if the weather held, if Burnham completed the other buildings on time, if strikes did not destroy the fair, if the many committees and directors, which Olmsted called that army our hundreds of masters, learned to leave Burnham alone, Olmsted might be able to complete his task on time. A writer for Engineering Magazine asked the question no one had raised at the rookery. How is it possible that this vast amount of construction, greatly exceeding that of the Paris Exhibition of 1889, will be ready in 2 years. For Burnham, too, the meeting in the rookery had produced a heightened awareness of how little time remained. Everything seemed to take longer than it should, and nothing went smoothly. The first real work in Jackson Park began on February 11th, when 50 Italian immigrants employed by MacArthur Brothers, a Chicago company, began digging a drainage ditch. It was nothing. Routine. But word of the work spread, and 500 union men stormed the park and drove the workers off. 2 days later, Friday the 13th, 600 men gathered at the park to protest MacArthur's use of what they alleged were imported workers. The next day, 2,000 men, many armed with sharpened sticks, advanced on MacArthur's workers, seized two, and began beating them. Police arrived. The crowd backed off. MacArthur asked Mayor Krieger for protection. Krieger assigned the city's corporation counsel, a young lawyer named Clarence Darrow, to look into it. Two nights later, the city's unions met with officers of the fair to demand that they limit the workday to 8 hours, pay union-scale wages, and hire union workers before all others. After 2 weeks of deliberation, the fair's directors accepted the 8-hour day, but said they'd think about the rest. There was conflict, too, among the fair's overseers. The National Commission, comprised of politicians and headed by Director General George Davis, wanted financial control. The Exposition Company, run by Chicago's leading businessmen and headed by President Lyman Gage, refused. The company had raised the money, and by God, the company would spend it in whatever way it chose. Committees ruled everything. In his private practice, Burnham was accustomed to having complete control over expenditures needed to build his skyscrapers. Now he needed to seek approval from the Exposition Company's executive committee at every step, even to buy drafting boards. The committee seldom objected to anything Burnham asked for, but it met only once a week, on Wednesdays at 3 o'clock. Thus, each petition, no matter how readily endorsed, squandered time. Maybe just a few hours, maybe an entire week. It was all immensely frustrating. "We must push this now," Burnham said. "The delays have seemed interminable." But he did make progress. He directed a contest to choose a female architect to design the woman's building for the fair. Sophia Hayden of Boston won. She was 21 years old. Her fee was the prize money, $1,000. The male architects each got $10,000. There had been skepticism that a mere woman would be able to conceive such an important building on her own. Examination of the facts show that this woman had no help whatever in working up the designs, Burnham wrote. It was done by herself in her home. In March, all the architects acknowledged that if they built their structures as originally planned, out of stone, steel, and brick, the buildings could not possibly be finished by opening day. They voted instead to clad their buildings in staff, a resilient mixture of plaster and jute that could be molded into columns and statuary and spread over wood frames to provide the illusion of stone. "There will not be a brick on the grounds," Burnham said. In the midst of all this, as the workload increased, Burnham realized he could put off no longer the hiring of a designer to replace his beloved John Root. He needed someone to manage his firm's ongoing work while he tended to the exposition. A friend recommended Charles B. Atwood of New York. McKim shook his head. There were stories about Atwood and questions of dependability. Nonetheless, Burnham arranged to meet Atwood in New York at the Brunswick Hotel. Atwood stood him up. Burnham waited an hour, then left for the train station. As he was crossing the street, a handsome man in a black bowler and cape with black gun muzzle eyes approached him and asked if he was Mr. Burnham. "I am," Burnham said. "I'm Charles Atwood. Did you want to see me?" Burnham glared. "I am going back to Chicago. I'll think it over and let you know." Burnham caught his train. Once back in Chicago, he went directly to his office. A few hours later, Atwood walked in. He had followed Burnham from New York. Burnham gave him the job. Atwood had a secret, as it happens. He was an opium addict. It explained those eyes and his erratic behavior. But Burnham thought him a genius. As a reminder to himself and anyone who visited his office in the shanty, Burnham posted a sign over his desk bearing a single word: RUSH. Time was so short, the executive committee began planning exhibits and appointing World's Fair commissioners to secure them. In February, the committee voted to dispatch a young Army officer, Lieutenant Mason A. Schufeldt, to to Zanzibar to begin a journey to locate a tribe of pygmies only recently revealed to exist by explorer Henry Stanley, and to bring to the fair a family of 12 or 14 of the fierce little midgets. The committee gave Lieutenant Shufeld 2.5 years to complete his mission. Beyond the fair's new fence, turmoil and grief engulfed Chicago. Union leaders threatened to organize unions worldwide to oppose the fair. The Inland Architect, a prominent Chicago journal, reported, "That un-American institution, the trades union, has developed its un-American principle of curtailing or abolishing the personal freedom of the individual in a new direction, that of seeking, as far as possible, to cripple the World's Fair." Such behavior, the journal said, would be called treason in countries less enlightened and more arbitrary than ours. The nation's financial condition worsened. Offices in the newest of Chicago's skyscrapers remained vacant. Just blocks from the rookery, Burnham and Root's temperance building stood huge and black, and largely empty. 25,000 unemployed workers roamed the city. At night, they slept in police stations and in the basement of City Hall. The unions grew stronger. The old world was passing. P.T. Barnum died. Grave robbers attempted to steal his corpse. William Tecumseh Sherman died too. Atlanta cheered. Reports from abroad asserted, erroneously, that Jack the Ripper had returned. Closer at hand, a gory killing in New York suggested he might have migrated to America. In Chicago, the former warden of the Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet, Major R.W. McClary, began readying the city for the surge in crime that everyone expected the fair to produce, establishing an office in the auditorium to receive and distribute Bertillon identifications of known criminals. Devised by French criminologist Alphonse Bertillon, the system required police to make a precise survey of the dimensions and physical peculiarities of suspects. Bertillon believed that each man's measurements were unique, and thus could be used to penetrate the aliases that criminals deployed in moving from city to city. In theory, a detective in Cincinnati could telegraph a few distinctive numbers to investigators in New York, with the expectation that if a match existed, New York would find it. A reporter asked Major McClary whether the fair really would attract the criminal element. He paused a moment, then said, "I think it quite necessary that the authorities here should be prepared to meet and deal with the greatest congregation of criminals that ever yet met in this country." Cuckoldry. At the Holmes Building at 63rd and Wallace, now known widely in the neighborhood as the Castle, the Connor family was in turmoil. Lovely, dark Gertrude, Ned's sister, one day came to Ned in tears and told him she could not stay in the house another moment. She vowed to catch the first train back to Muscatine, Iowa. Ned begged her to tell him what had occurred, but she refused. Ned knew that she and a young man had begun courting and believed her tears must have resulted from something he had said or done. Possibly the two had been indiscreet, although he did not think Gertrude capable of so drastic a moral lapse. The more he pressed her for an explanation, the more troubled and adamant she became. She wished she had never come to Chicago. It was a blighted, hellish place full of noise and dust and smoke and inhuman towers that blocked the sun, and she hated it. Hated especially this gloomy building and the ceaseless clamor of construction. When Holmes came by, she would not look at him. Her color rose. Ned did not notice. Ned hired an express company to collect her trunk and saw her to the station. She still would not explain. Through tears, she said goodbye. The train huffed from the station. In Iowa, in safe, bland Muscatine, Gertrude fell ill, an accident of nature. the disease proved fatal. Holmes told Ned how sorry he was to hear of her passing, but in his eyes there was only a flat blue calm, like the lake on a still August morning. With Gertrude gone, the tension between Ned and Julia increased. Their marriage never had been tranquil. Back in Iowa, they had come close to separating. Now, again, their relationship was crumbling. Their daughter, Pearl, became commensurately more difficult to manage, her behavior marked by periods of sullen withdrawal and eruptions of anger. Ned understood none of it. He was of an easygoing, innocent nature, a reporter later observed. He mistrusted nothing. He did not see what even his friends and regular customers saw. "Some of my friends told me there was something between Holmes and my wife," he said later. "At first, I did not believe it." Despite the warnings and his own mounting uneasiness, Ned admired Holmes. While he, Ned, was but a jeweler in someone else's store, Holmes controlled a small empire and had yet to turn 30 years old. Holmes's energy and success made Ned feel even smaller than he already was inclined to feel, especially now that Julia had begun looking at him as if he had just emerged from a rendering vat at the stockyards. Thus, Ned was particularly susceptible to an offer from Holmes that seemed likely to increase his own stature in Julia's eyes. Holmes proposed to sell Ned the entire pharmacy under terms that Ned, naive Ned, found generous beyond all expectation. Holmes would increase his salary to $18 a week from 12, so that Ned could pay Holmes $6 a week to cover the purchase. Ned wouldn't even have to worry about handling the $6. Holmes would deduct it from the new $18 salary each week automatically. Holmes promised also to take care of all the legal details and to record the transfer with city officials. Ned would get his $12 a week just as always, but now would be the owner of a fine store in a prosperous neighborhood, destined to become even wealthier once the World's Fair began operation. Ned accepted, giving no thought to why Holmes would wish to shed such a healthy business. The offer eased his concerns about Holmes and Julia. If Holmes and she were involved in an indiscreet liaison, would he offer Ned the jewel of his Englewood empire? To Ned's sorrow, he soon found that his new status did nothing to ease the tension between himself and Julia. The ferocity of their arguments only increased, as did the length of the cold silences that filled whatever other time they spent together. Holmes was sympathetic. He bought Ned lunch at the first-floor restaurant and told Ned how certain he was that the marriage would be salvaged. Julia was an ambitious woman and clearly a very beautiful one, but she would come to her senses in short order. Holmes's sympathy was disarming. The idea that Holmes might be the cause of Julia's discontent seemed more and more improbable. Holmes even wanted Ned to buy life insurance, for surely once his marital strife subsided, he would want to protect Julia and Pearl from destitution in the event of his death. He recommended that Ned also consider insuring Pearl's life, and even offered to pay the initial premiums. He brought an insurance man, C.W. Arnold, to meet with Ned. Arnold explained that he was building a new agency and wanted to sell as many policies as possible in order to attract the attention of the biggest insurance companies. To secure a policy, all Ned had to pay was $1, Arnold said. Just $1 to begin protecting his family forever. But Ned did not want a policy. Arnold tried again to change his mind. Ned refused and refused, and finally told Arnold that if he really needed $1, Ned would simply give him one. Arnold and Holmes looked at each other, their eyes empty of all expression. Soon creditors began appearing at the pharmacy demanding repayment of mortgages secured by the store's furnishings and its stock of salves and ointments and other goods. Ned was unaware of the existence of these debts and believed the creditors were trying to defraud him, until they presented documents signed by the previous owner, H. H. Holmes. Convinced now that these were bona fide debts, Ned promised to pay them as soon as he was able. Here, too, Holmes was sympathetic, but there was nothing he could do. Any thriving venture accumulated debts. He had assumed that Ned understood at least that much about business. At any rate, it was something to which Ned now would have to become accustomed. The sale, he reminded Ned, was final. This latest disappointment rekindled Ned's uneasiness about Holmes and Julia. He began to suspect that his friends might indeed be correct in believing that Holmes and Julia were engaged in an illicit affair. It would explain the change in Julia, certainly, and might even explain Holmes' sale of the pharmacy. An unstated trade. The store in exchange for Julia. Ned did not yet confront Julia with his suspicions. He told her simply that if her behavior toward him did not change, if her coldness and hostility continued, he and she would have to separate. She snapped, "Separation couldn't come too soon to suit me." But they remained together a short while longer. Their battles became more frequent. Finally, Ned shouted that he was done. The marriage was over. He spent the night in the barber shop on the first floor, directly below their apartment. He heard her footsteps as she moved about on the floor above. The next morning he told Holmes he was leaving and would abandon his interest in the store. When Holmes urged him to reconsider, Ned merely laughed. He moved out and took a new job with a jewelry store in downtown Chicago, H. Purdy and Company. Pearl remained with Julia and Holmes. Ned made one more attempt to win back his wife. "I told her after I left the building that if she would return to me and stop her quarreling, we would live together again. But she refused to come back." Ned vowed that one day he would return for Pearl. Soon he left Chicago and moved to Gilman, Illinois, where he met a young woman and began a formal courtship, which compelled him to visit Holmes's building one more time to seek a divorce decree. He got it, but failed to gain custody of Pearl. With Ned gone and the divorce final, Holmes's interest in Julia began to dissipate. He had promised her repeatedly that he would marry her once the decree was confirmed, but now he found the prospect repulsive. Pearl's sullen, accusing presence had become especially unappealing. At night, after the first-floor stores had closed and Julia and Pearl and the building's other tenants were asleep, he sometimes would descend to the basement, careful to lock the door behind him, and there ignite the flames of his kiln and marvel at its extraordinary heat. Vexed. Burnham saw his family rarely now. By the spring of 1891, he was living full-time in the shanty at Jackson Park. Margaret stayed in Evanston with a few servants who helped her care for their five children. Only a modest train ride separated the Burnhams, but the mounting demands of the fare made that distance as difficult to span as the Isthmus of Panama. Burnham could send telegrams, but these forced a cold and clumsy brevity and afforded little privacy. So Burnham wrote letters, and wrote them often. "You must not think this hurry of my life will last forever," he wrote in one letter. "I shall stop after the World's Fair. I have made up my mind to this." The exposition had become a hurricane, he said. "To be done with this flurry is my strongest wish." Every dawn, he left his quarters and inspected the grounds. 6 steam-powered dredges the size of floating barns gnawed at the lakeshore as 5,000 men with shovels and wheelbarrows and horse-drawn graders slowly scraped the landscape raw, many of the men wearing bowlers and suit coats as if they just happened to be passing by and on impulse chose to pitch in. Despite the presence of so many workers, there was a maddening lack of noise and bustle. The park was too big, the men too spread out to deliver any immediate sense of work being done. The only reliable signs were the black plumes of smoke from the dredges and the ever-present scent of burning leaves from slash piles set aflame by workers. The brilliant white stakes that marked the perimeters of buildings imparted to the land the look of a Civil War burial ground. Burnham did find beauty in the rawness. Among the trees of the wooded island, the long white tents of the contractor's camp gleamed in the sun, a soft white note in the dun-colored landscape, and the pure blue line of the lake horizon made a cheerful contrast to the rugged and barren foreground. But he also found deep frustration. The exposition was like a great ocean liner powered by a single sail, that sail being Burnham. The work advanced slowly, impeded by the worsening relationship between the fair's two ruling bodies, the National Commission and the Exposition Company, and by the architect's failure to get their drawings to Chicago on time. All the drawings were late. Equally aggravating was the fact there still was no Eiffel Challenger. Moreover, the exposition had entered that precarious early phase common to every great construction project when unexpected obstacles suddenly emerge. Burnham knew how to deal with Chicago's notoriously flimsy soil, but Jackson Park surprised even him. Initially, the bearing capacity of its ground was practically an unknown quality, as one engineer put it. In March 1891, Burnham ordered tests to gauge how well the soil would support the grand palaces then on the architect's drafting tables. Of special concern was the fact that the buildings would be sited adjacent to newly dug canals and lagoons. As any engineer knew, soil under pressure tended to shift to fill adjacent excavations. The fair's engineers conducted the first test 12 feet from the lagoon on ground intended to support the northeast corner of the electricity building. They laid a platform 4 feet square and loaded it with iron to a pressure of 2,750 pounds per square foot, 22 tons in all. They left it in place for 15 days and found it settled only 1/4 inch. Next, they dug a deep trench 4 feet from the platform. Over the next 2 days, the platform sank another 1/8 inch, but no farther. This was good news. It meant that Burnham could use Root's floating grillage for foundations without having to worry about catastrophic settlement. To make sure these properties were constant throughout the park, Burnham had his chief engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, test locations earmarked for other buildings. The tests yielded similar results until Gottlieb's men came to the site intended for Henry Post's gigantic manufacturers and liberal arts building. The soil destined to support the northern half of the building showed total settlement of less than 1 inch, consistent with the rest of the park. At the southern end of the site, however, the men made a disheartening discovery. Even as workers loaded the platform, it sank 8 inches. Over the next 4 days, it settled 30 inches more and would have continued sinking if the engineers had not simply called off the test. Of course, nearly all the soil of Jackson Park was competent to support floating foundations, except the one portion destined to bear the fair's biggest and heaviest building. Here, Burnham realized, contractors would have to drive piles at least down to Hardpan, an expensive complication and a source of additional delay. The problems with this building, however, had only just begun. In April 1891, Chicago learned the results of the latest mayoral election. In the city's richest clubs, industrialists gathered to toast the fact that Carter Henry Harrison, whom they viewed as overly sympathetic to organized labor, had lost to Hempstead Washburn, a Republican. Burnham, too, allowed himself a moment of celebration. To him, Harrison represented the old Chicago of filth, smoke, and vice, everything the fair was designed to repudiate. The celebrations were tempered, however, by the fact that Harrison had lost by the narrowest of margins, fewer than 4,000 votes, and what's more, had achieved this near victory without the support of a major party. Shunned by the Democrats, he had run as an independent. Elsewhere in the city, Patrick Prendergast grieved. Harrison was his hero, his hope. The margin was so narrow, however, that he believed if Harrison ran again, he would win. Prendergast resolved to double his own efforts to help Harrison succeed. In Jackson Park, Burnham faced repeated interruptions stemming from his de facto role as ambassador to the outside world, charged with cultivating goodwill and future attendance. Mostly these banquets, talks, and tours were time-squandering annoyances, as in June 1891, when, at the request of Director General Davis, Burnham hosted a visit to Jackson Park by a battalion of foreign dignitaries that consumed 2 full days. Others were purely a pleasure. A few weeks earlier, Thomas Edison, known widely as the Wizard of Menlo Park, had paid a visit to Burnham's shanty. Burnham showed him around. Edison suggested the exposition use incandescent bulbs rather than arc lights, because the incandescent variety produced a softer light. Where arc lights could not be avoided, he said, they should be covered with white globes. And, of course, Edison urged the fair to use direct current, DC, the prevailing standard. The civility of this encounter belied a caustic battle being waged outside Jackson Park for the rights to illuminate the exposition. On one side was General Electric Company, which was created when J.P. Morgan took over Edison's company and merged it with several others, and which now proposed to install a direct current system to light the fair. On the other side was Westinghouse Electric Company, with a bid to wire Jackson Park for alternating current, using patents its founder, George Westinghouse, had acquired a few years earlier from Nikola Tesla. General Electric offered to do the job for $1.8 million, insisting the deal would not earn a penny's profit. A number of exposition directors held General Electric stock and urged William Baker, president of the fair since Lyman Gage's April retirement, to accept the bid. Baker refused, calling it extortionate. General Electric rather miraculously came back with a bid of $554,000. But Westinghouse, whose AC system was inherently cheaper and more efficient, bid $399,000. The exposition went with Westinghouse and helped change the history of electricity. The source of Burnham's greatest dismay was the failure of the architects to finish their drawings on schedule. If he had once been obsequious to Richard Hunt and the Eastern Men, he was not now. In a June 2, 1891 letter to Hunt, he wrote, "We are at a dead standstill waiting for your scale drawings. Can't we have them as they are and finish here?" 4 days later, he again prodded Hunt. "The delay you are causing us by not forwarding scale drawings is embarrassing in the extreme." To Peabody, "We are completely put out with the delay on your building." That same month, a serious, if unavoidable, interruption hobbled the landscape department. Olmsted became ill, severely so. He attributed his condition to poisoning from an arsenic-based pigment called turkey red in the wallpaper of his Brookline home. It may, however, simply have been another bout of deep blue melancholia, the kind that had assailed him off and on for years. During his recuperation, Olmsted ordered bulbs and plants for cultivation in 2 large nurseries established on the fairgrounds. He ordered Dusty Miller, Carpet Bugle, President Garfield Heliotrope, Speedwell, Penny Royal, English and Algerian ivies, verbena, vinca, and a rich palette of geraniums, among them Black Prince, Christopher Columbus, Mrs. Turner, Crystal Palace, Happy Thought, and Jeanne d'Arc. He dispatched an army of collectors to the shores of Lake Calumet, where they gathered 27 train car loads of iris, sedge, bulrush, and other semi-aquatic plants and grasses. They collected an additional 4,000 crates of pond lily roots, which Olmsted's men quickly planted, only to watch most of the roots succumb to the ever-changing levels of the lake. In contrast to the lush growth within the nurseries, the grounds of the park had been scraped free of all vegetation. Workers enriched the soil with 1,000 carloads of manure shipped from the Union stockyards, and another 2,000 collected from the horses working in Jackson Park. So much exposed earth and manure became a problem. It was bad enough during the hot weather when a south wind could blind the eyes of man and beast, wrote Rudolf Ulrich, Olmsted's landscape superintendent at the park, but still worse during wet weather, the newly filled ground, which was still undrained, becoming soaked with water. Horses sank to their bellies. It was midsummer 1891 by the time the last of the architect's drawings was completed. As each set came in, Burnham advertised for bids. Recognizing that the architect's delays had put everything behind schedule, he inserted into the construction contracts clauses that made him a czar, as the Chicago Tribune put it. Each contract contained a tight deadline for completion, with a financial penalty for every day beyond. Burnham had advertised the first contract on May 14th, this for the mines and mining building. He wanted it finished by the end of the year. That left, at best, about 7 months for construction, roughly the amount of time a 21st century homeowner would need to build a new garage. He is the arbiter of all disputes, and no provision is made for an appeal from his decision, the Tribune reported. If, in the opinion of Mr. Burnham, the builder is not employing a sufficient force of men to complete the work on time, Mr. Burnham is authorized to engage men himself and charge the cost to the builder. The mines building was the first of the main exposition buildings to begin construction, but the work did not start until July 3, 1891, with less than 16 months remaining until dedication day. As construction of the buildings at last got underway, anticipation outside the park began to increase. Colonel William Cody, Buffalo Bill, sought a concession for his Wild West show, newly returned from a hugely successful tour of Europe, but the fair's Committee on Ways and Means turned him down on grounds of incongruity. Undeterred, Cody secured rights to a large parcel of land adjacent to the park. In San Francisco, a 21-year-old entrepreneur named Saul Bloom realized the Chicago Fair would let him, at last, take advantage of an asset he had acquired in Paris 2 years earlier. Entranced by the Algerian village at the Paris Exposition, he had bought the rights to display the village and its inhabitants at future events. The Ways and Means Committee rejected him, too. He returned to San Francisco intent on trying a different, more oblique means of winning a concession, one that ultimately would get him a lot more than he had bargained for. Meanwhile, young Lieutenant Schufeld had reached Zanzibar. On July 20th, he telegraphed Exposition President William Baker that he was confident he could acquire as many pygmies from the Congo as he wished, provided the King of Belgium consented. President Baker wants these pygmies, the Tribune said, and so does everybody else around headquarters. On the drafting board, the fair did look spectacular. The centerpiece was the Grand Court, which everyone had begun calling the Court of Honor. With its immense palaces by Hunt, Post, Peabody, and the rest, the court by itself would be a marvel. But now nearly every state in the nation was planning a building, as were some 200 companies and foreign governments. The exposition promised to surpass the Paris Exposition on every level. Every level, that is, except one. And that persistent deficit troubled Burnham. The fair still had nothing planned that would equal, let alone eclipse, the Eiffel Tower. At nearly 1,000 feet in height, the tower remained the tallest structure in the world and an insufferable reminder of the triumph of the Paris Exposition. To out-Eiffel Eiffel had become a battle cry among the directors. A competition held by the Tribune brought a wave of implausible proposals. C.F. Richel of Bridgeport, Connecticut, suggested a tower with a base 100 feet high by 500 feet wide, within which Richel proposed to nest a second tower, and in this one, a third. At intervals, a complicated system of hydraulic tubes and pumps would cause the towers to telescope slowly upward, a journey of several hours, then allow them to sink slowly back to their original configuration. The top of the tower would house a restaurant, although possibly a bordello would have been more apt. Another inventor, J.B. McComber, representing the Chicago Tower Spiral Spring Ascension and Toboggan Transportation Company, proposed a tower with a height of 8,947 feet, nearly nine times the height of the Eiffel Tower, with a base 1,000 feet in diameter sunk 2,000 feet into the earth. Elevated rails would lead from the top of the tower all the way to New York, Boston, Baltimore, and other cities. Visitors ready to conclude their visit to the fair and daring enough to ride elevators to the top would then toboggan all the way back home. As the cost of the tower and its slides is of secondary importance, McComber noted, I do not mention it here, but will furnish figures upon application. A third proposal demanded even more courage from visitors. This inventor, who gave his initials as RTE, envisioned a tower 4,000 feet tall, from which he proposed to hang a 2,000-foot cable of best rubber. Attached at the bottom end of this cable would be a car seating 200 people. The car and its passengers would be shoved off a platform and fall without restraint to the end of the cable, where the car would snap back upward and continue bouncing until it came to a stop. The engineer urged that, as a precaution, the ground be covered with 8 feet of feather bedding. Everyone was thinking in terms of towers, but Burnham, for one, did not think a tower was the best approach. Eiffel had done it first and best. More than merely tall, his tower was grace frozen in iron, as much an evocation of the spirit of the age as Chartres had been in its time. To build a tower would be to follow Eiffel into territory he already had conquered for France. In August 1891, Eiffel himself telegraphed the directors to ask if he might submit a proposal for a tower. This was a surprise, and at first, a welcome one. Exposition President Baker immediately cabled Eiffel that the directors would be delighted to see whatever he proposed. If the fair was to have a tower, Baker said in an interview, Monsieur Eiffel is the man to build it. It would not be so much of an experiment if he should be in charge of its construction. He might be able to improve on his design for the Eiffel Tower in Paris, and I think it fair to assume that he would not construct one in any way inferior to that famous structure. To the engineers of America, however, this was a slap in the face. Over the next week and a half, telegrams shot from city to city, engineer to engineer, until the story became somewhat distorted. Suddenly it seemed as if an Eiffel Tower in Chicago was a certainty, that Eiffel himself was to do the out-Eiffeling. The engineers were outraged. A long letter of protest arrived at Burnham's office, signed by some of the nation's leading engineers. Acceptance of the distinguished gentleman's offer, they wrote, would be equivalent to a statement that the great body of civil engineers in this country, whose noble works attest their skill abroad as well as throughout the length and breadth of the land, lack the ability to cope with such a problem, and such action could have a tendency to rob them of their just claim to professional excellence. Burnham read this letter with approval. It pleased him to see America's civil engineers at last expressing passion for the fair, although in fact the directors had promised nothing to Eiffel. His formal proposal arrived a week later, envisioning a tower that was essentially a taller version of what he had built in Paris. The directors sent his proposal out for translation, reviewed it, then graciously turned it down. If there was to be a tower at the fair, it would be an American tower. For now, however, the drafting boards of America's engineers were dishearteningly barren. Saul Bloom, back in California, took his quest for a concession for his Algerian village to an influential San Franciscan, Mike DeYoung, publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle and one of the exposition's national commissioners. Bloom told him about the rights he had acquired in Paris and how the exposition had rebuffed his petition. DeYoung knew Bloom. As a teenager, Bloom had worked in DeYoung's Alcazar Theater and worked his way up to become its treasurer at age 19. In his spare time, Bloom had organized the ushers, checkers, and refreshment sellers into a more efficient, cohesive structure that greatly increased the theater's profits and his own salary. Next, he organized these functions at other theaters and received regular commissions from each. At the Alcazar, he inserted into scripts the names of popular products, bars, and restaurants, including the Cliff House, and for this received another stream of income. He also organized a cadre of professional applauders known as a claque to provide enthusiastic ovations, demand encores, and cry brava for any performer willing to pay. Most performers did pay, even the most famous diva of the time, Adelina Patti. One day Bloom saw an item in a theatrical publication about a novel Mexican band that he believed Americans would adore, and convinced their manager to let him bring the band north for a tour. Bloom's profit was $40,000. At the time, he was only 18. DeYoung told Bloom he would investigate the situation. 1 week later, he summoned Bloom back to his office. "How soon could you be ready to go to Chicago?" he asked. Bloom, startled, said, "In a couple of days, I guess." He assumed DeYoung had arranged a second opportunity for him to petition the fair's Ways and Means Committee. He was hesitant and told DeYoung he saw no value in making the journey until the exposition's directors had a better idea of the kinds of attractions they wanted. "The situation has advanced since our talk," DeYoung said. "All we need now is somebody to take charge." He gave Bloom a cable from the exposition company that empowered DeYoung to hire someone to manage the Midway Plaisance. "You've been elected," he said. "I can't do it," Bloom said. He did not want to leave San Francisco. "Even if I did, I've got too much at stake here to consider it." DeYoung watched him. "I don't want to hear another word from you till tomorrow," he said. In the meantime, DeYoung wanted Bloom to think about how much money he would have to be paid to overcome his reluctance. "When you come back, you can name your salary," he said. "I will either accept or reject it. There will be no argument. Is that agreeable?" Bloom did agree, but only because DeYoung's request gave him a graceful way of refusing the job. All he had to do, he figured, was name such an outrageous sum that DeYoung could not possibly accept it. "And as I walked down the street, I decided what it would be." Burnham tried to anticipate every conceivable threat to the fair. Aware of Chicago's reputation for vice and violence, Burnham insisted on the creation of a large police force, the Columbian Guard, and placed it under the command of Colonel Edmund Rice, a man of great valor who had faced Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Unlike conventional police departments, the Guard's mandate explicitly emphasized the novel idea of preventing crime, rather than merely arresting wrongdoers after the fact. Disease, too, posed dangers to the fair, Burnham knew. An outbreak of smallpox or cholera or any of the other lethal infections that roamed the city could irreparably taint the exposition and destroy any